The future is data-driven, personalized, contextual products that truly make the business that you're trying to do better and create the right kind of risk transfer. I think we're at an interesting point in insurance where historically we've all done a lot of large data kind of underwriting, right? So you're trying to just find patterns in large numbers. And I think we'll be in a position to start helping you solve the problems that are really your problems in a more personalized manner.
You have just heard from Shwetank Verma, co-founder and managing partner at Leo Capital, an early-stage venture capital fund focused on South and Southeast Asia. Shwetank leads InsurTech investments at the fund. We talk about some of Leo Capital's investments, where the exciting incumbent insurer versus InsurTech markets are, and the outlook for fundraising going into 2024, among other things. So let us dive right in.
I'm very excited to welcome Shwetank Verma, who's co-founder and managing partner at Leo Capital. Good afternoon, Shwetank. You're in Helsinki today.
Yeah, good evening, Norbert. Thank you for having me. It's a very rainy afternoon, but at least it's not too cold.
It's very hard to keep track of you. You're flying around quite a bit. I did see you in person during IVS in Kyoto. That was great. And with all the travel comes a good overview into the venture capital scene and then InsurTech in particular across the regions, which is really the topic we want to talk about today. But before we get into this, maybe a little bit about yourself. So the provocative questions are venture capitalists born or raised, meaning have you always been a venture capitalist or has some past led you to being a VC now at this stage of your life?
The way I'd like to answer this is probably two parts. There's a technical aspect of venture, which I think can be learned by anyone. So in that part, it is very much, you can be raised with it. And I think that's the smaller part of venture. The more interesting part of venture, the tougher part of venture, is the mindset that with which you come to venture and the comfort of ambiguity that you need to have as a venture capitalist. Let me address both of those things. Mindset, then one of the joys of venture is that you have a lot of people pitching a lot of ideas to you on a daily basis. In fact, the moment they learn that you're a venture capitalist, most people have an idea that they want to pitch to you. Now, if you're intellectually curious, if you enjoy learning, that's a great high. That's a part that the best VCs are really born with that, and they get a lot of energy from people pitching ideas to them, because otherwise it gets tiring and challenging quickly. Now, the two elements that are tough as a VC actually are, one, emotionally you have to be comfortable saying no a lot of times. You end up having to say no to most pitches because that's just the way the fund works. It's impossible to say yes to all the good ideas that you hear. And being able to manage your attitude towards that is important and it's difficult. The second part that's difficult is it takes a long time in venture to realize if you're doing a good job or not. So it's a long, ambiguous cycle. It takes time to see whether the companies you've invested in become large, become successful for the reasons that you thought they would become successful. You have a lot of patience as a VC. So I think a lot of elements that you need to be born with, and then, of course, some that can be trained and make you better at the edges.
With Leo Capital, do you have a specific focus? You're personally leading the InsurTech investment, but the fund as a whole, is there a specific focus, or are you going across industries?
At Leo, we are a generalist cross-sector fund. Between us, we cover everything from gaming to logistics to InsurTech, FinTech, digital health, and B2B enterprise SaaS. We are always happy to look at companies that are truly using technology in interesting ways and are technology-first companies. Within Leo as well, I of course look at our InsurTech, but I also look at our FinTech, digital health investments as well. All of us, all the partners look at SaaS. So SaaS is common to all the partners and then different partners have specialisms. For me, for FinTech and InsurTech and digital health, my partner Rajul does a lot more social commerce and of course deep tech SaaS. Dinesh does gaming and logistics and Ravi does Web3.
If you look at InsurTech, I find the label always fascinating. It feels like when we say InsurTech, we set a pretty broad boundary. Resource. There's a core of what an insurance business is, the underwriting, the distribution, the claims management. But then there's so many adjacent sectors or technologies that impact how we can think about insurance. It's almost limitless. How do you view InsurTech? How do you break it down for yourself from an investment thesis perspective?
Just this morning, I was discussing with the chief digital officer of Tokio Marine. So very topical. You can look at InsurTech with a very narrow lens, what you mentioned, which is just look at it from the value chain of insurance. So marketing, claims, underwriting, etc. But I don't like looking at it from that narrow lens. The way I think about insurance is it's a key enabler across all sectors. So I got one stat once that insurance almost touches 85% of GDP. And the way you think about it is, right, insurance is important for agriculture, it's important for shipping, it's important for cargo. It's a truly incredible industry which enables a lot of value transfer, value extraction, et cetera, to happen globally. So the way I think of insurance is, how can insurance become a key revenue generator for our portfolio? In my mind, almost, unless you're a pure play gaming company or something, you truly have a potential of being at least part insurtech. And a lot of our focus is, how can we help you create an insurance program within your, say, logistics startup or within your health tech startup, which can be a key element of monetization and reduces the requirement that you have to monetize from other business models or charge end consumers, et cetera. So maybe an example here is helpful. For instance, we are investors in a company called Vahak. This is one of the largest logistics network in India. Think of it like an Uber for trucks. The way they've managed to grow really fast is they made the core matching functionality free, but they charge you for cargo insurance, and that has become a very good and exciting monetization engine. So that's the way I think about insurance. It touches 85% of the global GDP. There's an opportunity to provide contextual, embedded, parametric kind of insurance in a lot of ways. And there is a lot of the tech tools that we invest in are creating truly unique data and insights into the risk of the particular activity. The future is data-driven, personalized, contextual products that truly make the business that you're trying to do better and create the right kind of risk transfer. But I think we're at an interesting point in insurance where historically, we've all done a lot of large data kind of underwriting, right? So you're trying to just find patterns in large numbers. And I think we'll be in a position to start helping you solve the problems that are really your problems in a more personalized manner.
It's a great definition. So that really leaves it limitless. Ultimately, you're talking about embedded insurance, if you want to use buzzwords, right? Do you like the term embedded insurance? Does it capture what you want to express?
The challenge with all buzzwords is that they become meaningless very quickly. I think embedded is becoming that, and everything is, it's like AI has become one of those things. I actually got a pitch the other day which said your tea made with AI, which I found quite amusing. It's hard to say that the buzzword captures everything, but if you can actually make it contextual, which is that you're offering insurance in the journey that matters for the customer, personalized so that the offer is actually relating to the risks and the challenges that I face, and ideally easy to claim, right? So parametric is another buzzword, but ideally something like that, which means that I don't have to think about filing a claim. It's automatic. If the bad event happens, if an adverse event happens, I get paid out. That to me is the future of insurance. And whether you want to call it embedded, you want to call it parametric, you want to call it contextual, whatever it is truly being customer first in that approach. We have been big believers in the embedded insurance story. We were early investors in CoverGenius. We invested in a few other enablers of embedded insurance. And of course, we're seeing that happen in our portfolio as well. Take the buzzword at the pinch of salt, but it is working.
You mentioned AI, so I need to pick on that. Obviously, it's another buzzword or another wave that's come over us with all the generative AI things. Where do you see that playing a major role in insurance?
Again, it's an exploding field, so I'm sure I'll get some of this wrong and it'll have impact which we can't foresee at the moment. But I think what's easy to foresee is, of course, marketing. We are already seeing a lot of pitches around personalizing the marketing copy and generating it on the fly and truly using your data to pitch the product to you. I do think that's going to be the low-hanging fruit for generative AI in insurance, in all aspects of marketing, lead generation, lead conversion, enabling agents to convert better. I see that as the simplest application of Gen AI and one that I think we will see adoption rocket along quickly. Other elements of the insurance value chain, if you think about claims, I don't really see a huge Gen AI use case there. And things like engagement, et cetera, I think that, again, there will be opportunities there to use generative AI to engage and interact with policyholders, but that will take some more time.
You're in Helsinki, you've been in Tokyo a few weeks ago, so you cover a broad range geographically. Where is the best traditional insurance market? So where are the incumbents the most progressive in terms of digital adoption and trying out new business models? Secondly, where's the hottest insurtech market? Where are the most interesting startups coming up from your perspective? And it might be the same country or region, or it might be different. I'd be curious to know.
Best is such a loaded word, no, but you know, I think lots of great things happening everywhere. Maybe to change that to where I've been most impressed. And from the incumbent adoption perspective, I actually have to go with India. Even the existing incumbent insurers have truly transformed their digital approach and are doing a phenomenal job of making it easy to buy online directly, engage online, lots of tools, etc. available. Honestly, it's a low bar. I don't want to name the country where I went on the website, tried to buy product, and they basically said, no, you still have to call an agent. We can't sell it to you online. So that is the country. It is quite far from Japan, where you still have to call to buy insurance. Significant parts of the world still don't sell you online insurance for anything that is not completely basic product, like travel or something. So if you're buying life insurance, it's incredible how many places still require you to talk to an agent, to actually do physical paperwork before you can even get a quote, let alone buy. That's to set the stage. Given that, I think the Indian insurers, incumbents have done a great job in digitizing the customer journeys, using this pirate data sources to actually being able to provide you quotes and do the entire journey end to end. From an insure tech perspective, the market that has caught my eye the most is the UK. We're seeing insurtechs across all different types of risks, from cyber to climate to the traditional risks like life, health, etc. And there is a very interesting minimum mass or a grouping that has come together, which is allowing a lot of ideas to bump into each other and interesting new products being created. So a slew of very exciting insurtechs in that market, and a very good enabler there called Insurtech UK, which has done a great job in bringing all that together and making, I think, the world aware of it. And I think that, again, is an inspiration for us in India as we try and improve our innovation quotient on the InsurTech side, and the other hat I wear as a co-founder of the India InsurTech Association to try and promote the InsurTech scene in India. There's a lot of potential in India, but we're still a bit behind on the InsurTech side.
India clearly is known for UPI payments, all based ultimately on originally the Aadhaar system, and so you have a digital ID. Did that play a major role for the digitization of the insurance industry as well?
The digital public infrastructure stack in India, so this is ID, which is Aadhaar. There's now a account aggregator framework, which is basically data consent, etc., allowing you to do data sharing easily. And then there is a documents layer. That has certainly made it easier for companies to adopt digital pathways, because everything has become digitized and it's easy to integrate. These are all publicly available APIs. What that has done is created a set of expectations across the populace that this is the baseline. You need to be able to do it digitally. That has required everyone to make the investment and get to that baseline. But I do think that a lot of the insurers in India have gone beyond this baseline and done a good job of truly making their processes and their thinking digital first, rather than applying digital to an existing offline process. Partly, this is also due to the fact that the insurers, private insurers in India, are quite new. India only really allowed insurers to start in the late 90s, early 2000s. So they're still young companies. In some ways, they're a bit more like startups rather than the 100-plus-year-old incumbents in, say, Japan or US. So there's a little bit more agility and flexibility there relative to their peers in the more developed markets.
If you look at financial services broadly, we had all these neo banks coming up, especially over the last 15 years since the global financial crisis. You have different models of what actually the neobank is. Some of them don't have a banking license. They run on banking as a service rails, maybe. But there are still quite a few that obtained banking licenses globally and have been successful to a different degree. We haven't really seen so many newer insurers, right? Is that simply a problem that the regulation on insurance to actually set up a new entity from a capital perspective is too prohibitive? Or do you think that's just lagging and we'll see a few more new insurers coming out as well?
Many answers. I think one thing is that it's actually easier from just a use case perspective to be a bank than an insurer. Things like payments, current accounts, etc. They don't require historical data. They don't require deep modeling. The pricing for these products is a lot easier to get right than pricing for a lot of insurance products. And of course, insurance also has this long tail risk. Fundamentally more complex to set up an insurer versus a bank. So I think that's one of the reasons where we've seen more banks rather than insurers. And also, I think the banking use case lends itself to much more innovation on the daily interaction, especially at the payments layer. You're interacting almost on a daily basis. And quite frankly, I think nobody wants to interact with the insurer on a daily basis. If you are, you're doing something wrong. That's been part of the puzzle, I think, in why banking has been moving so far ahead of insurance. The other thing, of course, regulation has been slow to catch up, and it's been more protective of incumbents, and rightly so, because again, insurance is a promise to pay in the future. You do need your insurer to hang around and have things like the minimum capitalization and an ability to fulfill the promises. So I get that, but yes, it has made life difficult for new insurers to start. Having said that, we have seen some, of course, Lemonade, Hippo. We can argue whether they've been successful or not, but they were certainly new. They started in 2015. In Asia as well, I think we've had Sing Life in Singapore, ACCO in India. They seem to be doing well. And I think Sing Life was amongst the first to offer end-to-end online purchase for life, etc. In Singapore. So again, bringing new innovation to the market. At Leo, we are very excited about new insurance. I think there's a huge opportunity to rethink an insurer from the ground up, basing it on data and analytics. And we have made investments in that space in Sweden in an insurer called AIR, E-I-R. And in India, in an insurer called RIA, which is awaiting licensing at the moment.
Can you give maybe another example or two on your portfolio companies that you're excited about?
At the highest level, of course, we're excited about all our portfolio companies. But going deeper into specifics, we have a company called Beto, which is a diabetes management platform in India, the largest diabetes management platform in India, that I'm super excited about, as they are now working with insurers to create truly data-driven products for diabetics, both on the medical and the life side. That's going to be a great example of how data can truly change how you think about underwriting what in the life industry is called impaired life, which is a terrible term, but that's the term that they use. You don't need to just necessarily add risk and add cost because you're giving a product to somebody who's got diabetes. It's a very manageable disease and data can prove how you manage it. So excited about Beto in India and as they scale out and become probably the largest diabetes platform in the world. But that's top of mind on an insurance perspective. The other theme that I'm very excited about, and it's not directly related to insurance, is what I call the India arbitrage opportunity. A lot of innovation has happened in India in payments, in identity, in data consent, etc. So businesses that have been built around these insights, how do you use the same insights to build businesses in other parts of the world? Maybe the simplest way to explain this is through an example. One of the big things has been UPI, zero MDR payments everywhere now. People make QR code payments. Cash has gone completely. Cash use has fallen quite a lot. How do we use the insights we've learned about building these products for merchants and for consumers in India and apply them to other parts of the world? So we have a company called Atoa, which is bringing QR code payments to the UK, being very successful and using open banking to mimic UPI. We're excited about these kind of opportunities. We've invested in account-to-account payments across the world, Atoa, ScanPay in the US, etc. And we're looking to do similar things around social commerce and a couple of other themes. So excited about these two themes at a large level as we build out the portfolio.
When you think about insurance in India with a large population, but also a very wide wealth distribution, what is actually the accessible market for insurance or insurtech in terms of the percentage of population in India?
This is an area of constant debate because at one level, you look at 1.4 billion and you say, okay, this is large enough. Two ways to think about it. One, a lot of studies have shown that once GDP per capita goes above, say, $3,000 on a PPP basis, that's when insurance really takes off. If you think about it, it makes sense. You first, a lot of the population is solving to just have enough money to pay for necessities. Then you're trying to save for some of the rainy days. And only once you reach that level, do you think about protecting what you have. So from a demand perspective, insurance demand picks up a lot once a country inflects past $3,000 on a P basis, which India is very close to doing. Depending on where you look at it, it's $2,200 to $2,500 per capita. That means that there is a significant amount of demand coming in. India's current market is about 100 billion in GWP, 120 billion GWP across all lines of business. And that should grow to 250 to 300 by 2030. So effectively, a whole new India in terms of GWP is going to be added in the next 5 to 7 years. That way, super exciting, but you have to think about it bottom up as well. So top down, super exciting. But bottom up, it's a bit more challenging. A lot of folks have spoken about there are three Indias, right? There's the 100 million global Indians who are wealthy by most standards, fully fluent English, and they can transact online without any problems. Then there's the next 500 million were middle class, but not fully fluent in English, but more vernacular. And that becomes more challenging because you have different vernacular languages, Hindi, Marathi. That sort of 600-700 is the target base that is currently transacting or researching and willing to transact online. And then the remaining 700 are really hard to reach online and probably won't be reachable online. So that's the target market at the moment that you need to solve for. And more than the 100 million, which are catered to by the incumbents and by everyone, actually, because that's where the big spend is. You have to think about how you cater to the next 500, 600 million. And that means you have to think about how you localize and make your products, et cetera, more accessible in different contexts other than purely an English and intent first kind of search first kind of context. How do you make it more discoverable? How do you change the way things people interact with your proposition?
You have a geographically very broad coverage, but then also the type of countries are very different. You're investing in India, Leo Capital is in Singapore, you're now in Helsinki, which is also a much smaller population. The economies, the demographics in these countries are so different. That maybe plays then again to the intellectual curiosity of liking all these different experiences and tying it together in a way that, as you said at the beginning, ultimately generates revenues for the insurers.
Certainly, sometimes I ask myself, why have we pushed ourselves so much? But that's the fun of it, right? And the world has become a much smaller place. I'm talking to you from Helsinki, you're in Tokyo, and we have listeners from all over the world. So I do see a lot of convergence happening across the world. And this is especially true on the B2B side. Consumers will always be slightly different. And again, our investments are a bit more B2B centric. Truly, technology is making the world a significantly smaller place with a lot of similarities. As VCs, at one level, we're just pattern matchers. If we are able to see and observe patterns all over the world, we'll hopefully become better investors in each part of the world. At least that's the thesis of which we are solving. And that's why Leo Capital is active in many different markets with a slight bigger bent towards B2B companies.
So it's part of the secret sauce that makes you successful as a VC. You can't really be isolated or focused on a narrow geography because the next big thing might just come from a market you haven't really investigated further.
There are many paths to success in ventures. You have to be true to yourself. There's no shortage of phenomenal funds who have done very well by focusing not only in just one country, some of them focus on just one geography, but they only invest in Chicago. But ultimately, you have to do what you want to do. And I think for us, this is the right approach.
Hi, Shwetank. Just a quick question. I believe Japan's considering adopting India's UPI system. And what are your thoughts? Does this create opportunities for Japanese entrepreneurs to look at India for any inspiration for business models that can be built on top of the UPI layer?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Partly, of course, Paytm and SoftBank have already entered the Japan market with PayPay, which has had some success in the market as well. But overall, there's a lot of opportunity, I think, globally, and given the current interest in Japan, for interesting sort of movement of ideas. So I do think there's an opportunity for Japanese entrepreneurs to see what technology adoption in leapfrogging looks like. How can you go from almost pen and paper to completely mobile first and rethink some of these opportunities in Japan? And that's a theme that we've been excited about and always interested in talking to entrepreneurs were inspired by something happened in India and bringing it to a different market.
Japan is a fantastic opportunity for any entrepreneur who's willing to take on some of the challenges that come with it. At the same time, certainly when you look maybe at the banks a little more than the insurers, but all the banks have made it clear that Southeast Asia is a future growth market. So I think there is a two-way opportunity that can be exploited.
A lot of the Japanese corporates are very excited and focused on India as the next growth market. We've seen CVCs in industries as wide as gaming to logistics to banking focus on India and Southeast Asia. Lots of opportunities. One of the challenges, of course, has been that there's a language barrier. So we haven't seen as much interchange of ideas and entrepreneurs as we see between India and the US. But a lot of opportunity if you are able to find the right partner, et cetera, in Japan for value creation as both an Indian entrepreneur and a Japanese entrepreneur.
Let me round this out with a final question and asking you to take out your crystal ball once more. Clearly, the first half of the year has been somewhat difficult fundraising environment for many entrepreneurs. Maybe in the answer, you can also share a little bit about how much new activity you maybe have done with Leo in the first half. Maybe you were a bit more active than others. What's your projection for the rest of the year and early 24? Where do you see this going?
From our perspective, we've continued to be fairly active. We've made 7 investments in the first half of this year, which is more or less an average for us. We typically make, say, 6 to 8 investments every 6 months. So we've been on the same cadence as before. I think the worst is behind us, especially for early stage, for the first check. A lot more people are willing to invest and, again, looking at building companies, etc. The key thing as an entrepreneur you have to think about is, How do you raise enough to have at least an 18-month runway, 18 to 24-month runway in the current environment? And the toughest time is if you raised a large seed round at the peak of the market, so 15-odd months ago, and you need to raise now. There you have to be mentally open to do a flat round or a down round, whatever it takes to stay alive. Don't wed yourself to a valuation, because I think that's the toughest part of the market at the moment, where there is no real desire to underwrite a lot of capital on an unproven business. So things like product market fit, path to profitability, three words that have become a bit lost in the heydays have come back. You need to think about that in your business as you try and fundraise in today's environment. But mostly, I think the complete doom and gloom is gone. Lots of green shoots. The seed market is fairly open. And ideally, we should see that the Series A market starts mostly back to life, I would say, by second quarter next year.
Well, that's a wonderful, positive outlook to end on. Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Shwetank. We hope to see you then soon in this part of the world.
Thank you, Norbert. Thank you for having me.